Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to New Books in History, a channel on the New Books Network. I'm Yana Byers, your host, and I'm here today with Kenneth L. Schonk, professor of history at University of Wisconsin-La Crosse, to talk about his new book, Ireland's New Traditionalists, Fianna Fáil, Republicanism and Gender, 1926 to 1938, out this year, that's 2021, with Cork University Press. Welcome, Ken.
Hi, thank you. It's a pleasure being here.
Oh, it's delightful. I'm so happy to have you on the show. So how badly did I murder the title of your book there?
Oh, you were pretty close. There are a couple pronunciations of the political party. The easiest way for non-Irish speakers is Fianna Fáil.
Fianna Fáil?
Fianna Fáil. If you want to get a little more Irish with it, you would say Fianna Fáil. So, but we'll just go with Fianna Fáil.
Fianna Fáil. All right. I think I sound less ridiculous. There. All right. How are things with you? How's Wisconsin?
It's great for the most part. I live in one of the most beautiful places in the state, right on the Mississippi River. I'm just finishing up my eighth year at UW-La Crosse. And so things are great. Got my first COVID shot a couple weeks ago.
Woo! That's so exciting. You are having a good year. You guys had a brutal winter, didn't you?
It wasn't too bad. We had about 3 weeks there where the temperature barely broke freezing. But in terms of snowfall, it was fairly mild. So it hasn't been too bad. And now spring is here and we see green and our crocuses and other plants are starting to come from the ground. So it's exciting.
How sweet. You sound like a real Midwesterner, and I know you're not. I know you're a California boy, but it sounds like the Midwest is getting to you. It's our secret. Everyone eventually assimilates. Okay. So let's get to the book. I want to contextualize the current work and like you as an historian. So I'm checking out your CV, and I see that you have a lot of interests, right? So you're a go-to guy for the history of sport. And then you published Historical Theory and Methods through Popular Music, 1970 to 2000. Those are the New Saints. It was Palgrave, 2017, which is this great book exploring historical theory and methods through our friend rock and roll. And then I see this other track, which seems like this other kind of maybe more serious meh, that shows you as an historian of modern Ireland. Your dissertation from the Wayback Machine and was titled Irish Blood, English Heart, Gender Modernity and the Third Way Republicanism and the Formation of the Irish Republic. And then you've done a good bit on 20th century Ireland before this book. I see a lot of thread. So how do you characterize yourself? What are you?
By training, I'm a historian of modern Ireland. But I also have these side projects, which you allude to or say, including the history of sport, which is more or less a teaching thing. But it also is reflective of the thing that really got me into history as a boy, really, was through sport. And that's how I learned to contextualize the past in a lot of ways, was by by looking at sport, especially baseball, and that's something that I think my parents and grandparents passed on to me, was a love of baseball, but also an acknowledgement of the past through baseball. And so sport has always been there. I played sports through high school and into college, and I even coached sports when I was a high school teacher in California for a time. And so sport has always been there, and it was really the prism through which I was able to understand and contextualize the past. The other side of that was, as I got a little bit older, was rock and roll. My parents would always play the Beatles. The 60s stations was always on the radio. And so I became fascinated with the past through music and in making comparisons between then and now. But what I realize now, and this is what informed the rock and roll book in a lot of ways, is that pop forms of popular culture, rock and roll and sports, especially baseball, became the language in which I came to understand the world around me. For example, I was introduced to Irish politics by way of U2. I would see the news about the troubles in the early 80s as a young kid, and it didn't quite make sense to me. And then I started to listen to U2, and it gave me some context that I was able to understand that. And so forms of popular culture helped develop the language of understanding the present, but also the past. We took that, my co-author, Dan McClure, and I used that as a starting point to develop this book on the history of rock and roll. He bringing in the theory side of it, mostly that's his strength, me bringing in more of the pedagogical aspect of it. And with that, started to think about how we could explain to others how to contextualize and view the past through a common language that we already have, which is our language of understanding, or the understanding of the language of popular culture. And so for me, and this came out in the process of writing those books, is that when we were watching MTV and we were seeing Madonna, we were seeing Culture Club videos, Frankie Goes to Hollywood, we were watching music, but for whatever reason, it was also it was educational for us, because what I was really learning about was feminism and femininity and aspects of queerness and so on and so forth. And so and then as we get into the later 80s, when MTV finally started playing music by Black artists, being taught by Public Enemy, Boogie Down Productions, De La Soul, that was our alternative education. And so that's something that I've built off of in my research, as in my side project, so to speak. But in terms of Ireland, how I came to Irish history was almost by accident in a lot of ways. When I was doing a master's in history, I entered a master's program in history at Cal State Fullerton. And I had no intent of going on and doing a PhD. But it was something to do in the evenings when I was teaching high school. And there I was supposed to, I entered with the intent of being an American historian. But for reasons I don't need to get into, I opted to not do the American track and decided to go down the European track. But the problem was I don't have really any foreign language skills. And so I had to pick something that was rooted in English. And so I fell back onto something that had always been of interest to me, which was Ireland and Ireland's history. And so that's where this book project began, was first as a seminar paper, then as a master's thesis, then as the dissertation, and then now, years later, finally as a manuscript.
All right. That's an interesting story kind of how this book happened. I mean, but the language skills you do, though, you have Irish, which is incomprehensible.
Yeah, it's a difficult language to learn. And I have very little. I took a year of it. But it's you can see why it is viewed as such a poetic language. It is lyrical and beautiful and so expressive in a lot of ways. But there are almost no cognates. So to go from English to Irish is really difficult. Whereas if you go into the Romance languages, as you know, there are some cognates, there are some similar grammatical structures or even into German. But with Irish, it's like starting from scratch. And I think the only cognates that I know of are smithereens, which is based on an Irish word, smitherini, and galore.
Those
are two Irish words that have been transported into English that I know of anyway.
I'm sure there is great cultural significance in how we got how those are the words that came from Irish into English. We'll probably have to talk about that over a beer sometime. So of all the things that you could have studied, though, with modern Irish history, you went into this. Like, how did this book happen? What made you decide you wanted to do this? Were there historiographical holes you were trying to fill? Like, what brought you here?
Yeah, definitely. There were some historiographical gaps that I found. Irish history is totally understandable. Has a very strong connection to the nation's identity, to the nationalist history of it. And there are various narratives in Irish history. The Republican narrative that basically says England's wrong and England caused all the problems in Ireland. There's the revisionist approach, which says, well, no, actually, it's far more complicated than that. And then we talk about how we're in the post-revisionist era, which means that in Irish history, we're opening ourselves up to conversations regarding gender and sexuality and class and some other things that move away from this notion of Ireland becoming a nation. That's very general, of course. But what I found with looking at Irish history, at least the starting points, I found that there's plenty written on the famine in the 19th century. There's plenty written on the Gaelic revival at the end of the 19th century, which, by the way, is the major point of interest for my dissertation advisor, Tim McMahon, and a lot on the 1916 rising, and then to the Troubles. And so there are these watershed moments that have an immense amount of research and writing done on them. And so I was trying to find where I could find some gaps. And I've always been interested in interwar Europe, interwar history. You know, going back to my original interests in history, that's when my grandparents came of age. And so I talked a lot about them, what it was like to live during the Depression. So it was always something that was of interest to me. And so that was a starting point. And then as I started to investigate the interwar period in Ireland, in the period after Ireland became the Irish Free State up to the period that it became basically a republic, I found that there was very little written on it. And so that was a starting point. And then I became very much enthralled by the key figure of this period, which is a man by the name of Emin de Valera. And he is largely unknown in history outside of Ireland. This is a guy who was basically the key political figure in Ireland from 1918 up until the 1960s. He served as president of Sinn Féin. He founded this party, Fianna Fáil, and he was prime minister or Taoiseach of Ireland for a number of years. Then he became president of Ireland. He was born in the United States. He was scheduled to be executed in the wake of the 1916 Easter Rising and was next in line to be executed before the British stopped it. So I became intrigued by this figure and why he was largely ignored. Like if you go to Ireland, there's very few places where you'll see De Valera Street or statues of De Valera. Everybody knows Michael Collins, but nobody knows De Valera. And so I found that to be interesting too. And so those were the starting points for me that got me interested into this topic. And I also found historiographically that people, or there's a lack of work on this interwar period in Ireland for whatever reason. I think in large part, it's because people tend to focus on the decade that precedes this period, the 1916 Easter Rising, the Anglo-Irish War, the Irish Civil War, of course, World War I. And so there was a gap there. And the works that do exist, which are fantastic, tend to be more focused on the political aspect of it the inner machinations of the party and of the government. And I found that there was very little in terms of the party's connection to Irish culture, the visual culture of politics in Ireland. And so those were the things that drew me in to the topic.
Okay. So one of your stated aims was to situate Ireland and Fianna Fáil within the broader European interwar zeitgeist. I mean, can you comment on that? What do you mean by, what is the interwar zeitgeist and what do you do there?
Yeah, that's something that popped up as I was looking at sources, and I know we'll talk a little bit about sources later, but in looking at some of the sources, I found that there was in the political ephemera of the party, that there was a level of anxiety about the present, a level of anxiety about notions of gender and how the party presented itself as a corrective, as a way to fix the past, to build the nation toward the future, as a way to correct notions of masculinity and femininity in the wake of national trauma and crises. Mirrors or parallels what is happening on the European continent. And so when I remember pulling up some of these visual artifacts from Irish newspapers and from Fianna Fáil in the 20s and 30s, I remember showing them to one of my professors at Marquette, where I did my PhD, who was a historian or is a historian of interwar Germany. And she looked at it and said, this is fascist or fascistic, that there's a similarity in the responses to what's happening. And so I found in those responses that need to correct, that need to fix a problem of the present so that it can, I think, mesh past and present to build toward the future. And so there's a lot of futurist elements in the party's propaganda, that it's about in many ways wish fulfillment. But more than anything, we see a party that is actively trying to lead the nation in a new direction. In the case of Ireland, it was leading Ireland toward full independence from Great Britain, but also to correct the legacies of colonialism, to correct the legacies of the violence that preceded the 1920s and 30s in Ireland. And so I saw in this party, much like you see in other parties in Europe at the time, a desire to be an activist government, because the failures of capitalism and the depression, and the really, I use the word torpid a lot in the book, of the torpid responses of governments to react to these kinds of things. And socialism was a no-go, or communism anyway, in Ireland for many reasons, mostly the Catholic Church. And so we see a party that is trying to navigate between capitalism, socialism, and bring the nation forward to actively lead to correct the ills of Ireland's past to create a big, brighter future. And so that's where the title, the new traditionalists, comes in. Is that's seemingly oxymoronic, and how can you be traditional but new? But that's one of the fundamental aspects of interwar European politics is that Janus or Palingenesis, where you have the old and the new coming together as a pathway forward.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I'm thinking about Italy, obviously, where I work. This is exactly the same thing. They were called the glories. Mm-hmm. This kind of really idealized past that never quite existed, as like this idea for an idealized future that, mm-hmm. in Italy is not coming.
Right.
We'll talk about what happens in Ireland. We mentioned your sources. Let's hit on that right now. Visual sources. You've got a lot of illustrations, political cartoons. Mm-hmm. What else? Tell me what else you use.
Yeah, the big source the basic sources that I use are the Irish newspapers from the time, primarily a newspaper called the Irish Press, which was began publication in 1931 and continued, I think, till the 1990s. But the Irish Press was founded by Eamon de Valera based on money that he raised in the United States in the 19 teens and 20s. There's actually, I think, a Supreme Court case that dealt with the funds, but he pulled those funds over and started this newspaper. So much like the rest of Europe, you have parties with their own house organs, as you know, they say, you know, their own newspapers. And so I was fortunate enough to be at a university that had the entire run of these newspapers on microfilm. And so I began doing my dissertation research. I had an idea of the topic, but in looking at these sources, I found a couple of things. One is there's on the front page, there's a political cartoon nearly every day that is essentially expressive of what the party wants to do. But the real entry point for me was on page three, sometimes page five of every edition of the Irish Press was a page or most of a page dedicated to matters related to women. And in there, I found that there were depictions of fashion, of what women should wear, of what women should do inside the home, and so on and so forth. And so having in mind this notion of the party being a corrective, I started to think about, okay, how are they trying to correct women? How are they trying to portray women? What's the message that the party is sending to women? And a lot of this is based upon some of the work that my friend Jason Knirk at Central Washington University has done, where he looks at the early 1920s with a party called Kamon Nagoya. And he argued that one of the things that this party did was that they presented the Irish Republican side for Sinn Féin and then Fianna Fáil as being feminized, as being overly emotional or reactionary. And a lot of it had to do with the fact that the people who were the public face of republicanism in Ireland in the early 1920s were women. And so they tried to present Irish women as disrupting the gender dynamic in Ireland, amongst other things. And so what I found in these newspapers is that Fianna Fáil was trying to redirect the energies of Irish women to get them off the street and to stop their protests and whatnot, but give them a carefully guarded political agency. And in this dynamic, I found that they were allowing women or encouraging women to dress in a modern way. And that's something that I found very interesting in looking at this over this period, is that they're encouraging women to wear the fashions of Paris or of New York or of other, you know, fashion hotspots. But they are carefully guarded in saying, well, you can dress in such a manner. We prefer you to dress in the old fashioned way, but if you're going to dress modern, do it in muted colors. And that's, I think it's the title of one of the chapters, which is Bright Days Are Coming in Quaker Gray, right? And so there's this carefully guarded agency that women are being told. And then you also have added to the fact that the party was saying through the newspaper that, yeah, you can wear modern fashions, but buy clothing and fabrics that are produced in Ireland. If you're going to wear clothes, have something that's gray, put on a colorful ribbon or a scarf that not only is made in Ireland, but is going to represent the colors of Fianna Fáil, of green, or to wear a trumpet, which was the symbol of the party. And so they're redirecting the political energies of women to support this more modern economic thing. And so this is very much evident through the visual culture that the party is promoting. And so that became the launching point. And so I started looking at other aspects of the newspaper, and I started to find, especially in a supplemental newspaper called the Fianna Fáil Bulletin, where the party seems to try to re-masculinize, if that's a word, Ireland. And so I found a lot of charts, images that depict things that can be described in no other way as being phallic. There's a picture in the book of wheat stacks that are not wheat stacks if you look at them, of a lot of arrows pointed upward, a lot of kinetic energy coming through in the ads, that this is a party that is using masculinized energy to bring the nation forward. And so I found this duality here where I see the party through its visual culture trying to present an idealized Irish feminine and an idealized Irish masculine. And then that was the corrective, and that the party were these models, and that the party, and this is where I go a little off the rails, I think in my book, is that I see this idea of reiterating this heteronormative balance in the idea that this idealized Irish feminine as depicted in the Irish press and this idealized Irish masculine as depicted in the Fianna Fáil Bulletin and other sources are going to provide the basis of a new national coitus to be this new free nation free from the vestiges of British colonialism and the more recent past. And so those sources really started to present this idea of this is a party that is consciously doing something. I mean, if this was done accidentally, it's the biggest and most fruitful accident in history. And so there's a sense there that they're doing this. And it goes up to 1937, basically, this kind of culture, because in 1937, De Valera, his party, presented to the people the Bun Riach na Héireann, or the Irish Constitution, which in many ways established a republic. The Constitution, by the way, is still in use today. But they got what they wanted. They got the new nation. And so then after that, you see things scaling back. And this is where this work also differs from a lot of the historiography, because rightfully so, the conventional wisdom is that Ireland has not been the most hospitable place for women. The aforementioned constitution says that, and this has been stricken, but that women's place is in the home. Her place in the home is I think the quote. And also being a place that's very socially, culturally conservative. But I found in this period, in this work, very brief period, relatively speaking, that there was this openness to women in many ways, a very guarded acceptance of the more modern women. Later in the run of the Irish press in the 30s, there were stories about how to become a nurse or a doctor or a lawyer for women. And so there's this guarded, I think, I don't want to say liberalism, but this guarded acceptance of the more modern woman that they slam the brakes on once Ireland becomes independent.
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious, ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor's the solution for fast, premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com/NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
And this modern Irish woman, though, she's still in the home, right? I mean, I want to read from this advert, as the Irish would say, yes. For Dramona Soaps, which is the text you used to open chapter 2. Is yours a real Irish home? Are you doing everything a patriotic Irish man or woman should do to support the industry of your country? We shall show you how you can have a real 100% Irish home, not only without entailing any sacrifice, but with immediate advantage to yourself in the matter of quality and price. And this, I mean, that's an interesting and fairly clear, I think, this idea about what it means to be an Irish, well, an Irish person who supports the home, but an Irish woman as well. It seems quite domestic. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, very much domestic, but still working toward, through that domesticity, working toward the aims of a Republican Ireland.
Mm-hmm. And it feels that, I mean, you have this whole chapter really about the way that women are going to be integral in the creation, you know, in designing this ideal Ireland. Mm-hmm. So then tell me, what's an ideal Irish man meant to be like? I mean, there are sheaves of wheat and arrows. So I think I have some idea, but like, expand there, please.
Yeah, I think especially in the depiction of men, we see that's where the futurism really comes in. That Irish men were to be granted by Fianna Fáil the right to return to the land, to harvest the land, to work the land that was theirs. And that's where that traditional primordial side comes in, right? To the restoration of the masculine to the field, right? But then there's also this futurist element of the party opening up factories for Irishmen to go to. And then there's some really great images in the book that depict this, where the party is depicted as the rising sun, which is very fascistic in a lot of ways. And I do want to mention that when I talk about interwar period and compare aspects of Fianna Fáil to parties on continental Europe, I'm not saying that Fianna Fáil was fascist at all, in no way, shape, or form. There was actually a fascist party in Ireland. The Blue Shirts didn't go anywhere, basically. But the party depicts itself as the sun, the center, the source of all life, and the new day dawning, shining over men marching into a factory. Right? They're just laborers, they're workers, right? There's no flash about them. And this is in contrast to the way in which they depict their opposition, Cumann na Gael, later Fine Gael, and depict them as being these submissives to Britain. They often depict members of the opposition party in coats with tails of presenting them as, you know, these almost dandyish type people. And they contrast that with themselves as the party of business suits and agricultural workers and so on. And there's an anecdote in the book about how a papal legation came to Ireland in 1932, not long after Fianna Fáil is voted into power. And the legation was met by De Valera and others, and they were dressed in business suits. And somebody from the Vatican commented that it looked like they were being greeted by bankers as opposed to politicians. And so they present themselves as these very masculine, not hyper masculine, but these masculine guys, in contrast to the British or the seemingly pro-British politicians. And so they wanted to present a restored masculinity that was not only primordial and you know, returned to the Irish land, but also modern. They talked about how De Valera had plans to start an automobile corporation in Ireland. They also tried to grow tobacco in Ireland, but that didn't work. So there's this sense that Irishmen would be, you know, one half of the equation to help restore the nation.
Mm-hmm. It seems like a very natural way to compare this sober farmer, business suit wearing guy to the English dandy. But did that happen? You don't write about it all that much. But are we just done with England at this point?
No, there's the chapter in which I talk about how this is the queering chapter. I think it's called mm-hmm. Queering John Bull, in which we see a very strong effort by the party to present to other essentially through gender to other its opponents. And so we see it almost kind of come full circle, where Fianna Fáil was formed in the wake of Sinn Féin being feminized by opposition parties. Now Fianna Fáil is not necessarily feminizing, but calling into question the masculinity in some ways of their political opponents.
Right. And that chapter is great, because it starts with this meeting at Dublin Castle. It's 1932. The Pope has come, and Eamon de Valera meets him. And I love that de Valera speaks in Irish and in Latin. And that seems incredibly significant to me. Here's who we are as a country. Mm-hmm. And it doesn't involve English.
Right, right. And de Valera was very much an advocate of the Irish language. In contrast to their political opponents, who were not Irish enough in a lot of ways. And I should say, too, that the political opposition, Cumann na Gael, later becomes Fine Gael, they are the party that establishes and maintains the Irish Free State, that they're very successful in what they do. And there's a lot of strategy. There's a lot of brilliance in what they do to establish a stable nation. And Fianna Fáil builds off of that. But they're able to do such things, you know, such as to present themselves as being more Irish, you know, for de Valera, who, by the way, was once president of the League of Nations, or future League of Nations leader, amongst other things. For him to do such a transgressive thing as to welcome the papal legation in Irish, you know, that's not accidental. And the party lined the streets with Republican colors and banners. And he turned this event into this national moment for the party. It's this very subtle or not so subtle thing that de Valera does.
And then this chapter takes a quick turn, and all of a sudden I'm reading about Judith Butler and Nikki Sullivan and Edward Said. It's like, what? Hold on. What happened here? Totally thrown for a loop, a good loop. I loved it. But it's a kind of a shift there. And then you're talking about the process of, you know, like queering and othering. It's a very specific thing that's happening. It's smart, like really well done. That's an interesting choice. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. And that, you know, referring to gaps in historiography, thankfully this has changed a lot, and I don't want to present myself as being in the vanguard of this, because that's not true at all. But thankfully in the last decade or so, or more, there's been more work done where you see the application of gender theory and queer theory to an extent to Irish history. And that's an exciting development. That's a big change, and I'm glad to be a part of it. But yeah, it's something that very concretely, I think, addresses those gaps in Irish historiography.
Right on. Excellent. Mm-hmm. Okay. I would like to read another portion. This study of Fianna Fáil's electoral aesthetic has shown that the party, consciously or not, constructed along gendered lines an appealingly aspirational vision of peace and prosperous Ireland, a peaceful and prosperous Ireland, where primordialism and an imagined Irish futurism were reconciled. More than anything else, Fianna Fáil recast republicanism in a new light, where political action and agency were no longer extra-legal and violent. Rather, the movement was fully ensconced as a defiantly transgressive party engaged in constitutional struggle to recast republicanism as more appealing to the nation's electorate. So that's a really grand vision. Did it work?
I think so. I'd like to think so, yeah. But yeah. We'll see what other people have to say about it. I'm interested in the conversation. And the gestation for this book has been long enough where I've presented enough at conferences where people have been encouraging with it. But if you're talking about the party itself and whether that worked or not, is that what you were asking?
Also that. I think okay. My opinion is that the book works. Which I would tell you if I didn't. But yeah, I think your book works. I would also like to know, but what happens with the party? What happens in Ireland? Is this, do they create their Ireland?
Yes and no. Yes, in terms of their ultimate aim of creating a fully independent Ireland. You have the establishment of ERA, E-I-R-E, with the 1937 Constitution. And then the 1940s, you have the full declaration of an Irish Republic and Ireland leaving the British Commonwealth. And as a side note to this, to show you, I think, the power of what Fianna Fáil had done is that the declaration of the Irish Republic in the 40s was done by the opposition, done by Fine Gael. And so you see this dramatic shift in how the party presents Ireland. The aims of an industrialized Ireland never really come to fruition. Some of that has to do with the scaling back of that vision after the Constitution, also the outbreak of World War II, or as they call it in Ireland, the emergency. And then you see De Valera becoming and his government becoming a little bit more conservative in their economic policy. They become very isolationist in a lot of ways. But that begins to shift in the 50s and 60s under other people. But the fact of the matter is that as a party, Fianna Fáil is still in existence today. They're very interestingly in a coalition government with Fine Gael, their enemies for the most part. For 80 years, it'd be as if the Democrats and Republicans in the United States joined together. But the divide between the two parties in Ireland are not as stark as the parties in America. But when that happened last year, this coalition government of the two parties, it was a pretty monumental thing to see happen, because we have these two parties that have been diametrically opposed are now working together. Whether they're working well together or not is another story. But this is the basis of Ireland. Whether what the party is doing, whether it's a conscious reaction against it, to what De Valera was trying to do, and in many ways the more contemporary rejection of the more conservative aspects of Ireland are being undone, as Ireland is now becoming one of the more liberal countries in Europe, if not the world.
Mm-hmm. But then there's also this, there's this industrial Ireland, but then I'm looking through the images you show in the book, and there's always a plow, right? There's a plow, yeah, somewhere, there's a field, there's something. So there's this idea of bucolic old Catholic Ireland as well, which seems to be really integral in the formation of the party's of Ireland's self-conception, right? We're speaking Latin as well as Irish here in this meeting. And this is extra outside the scope of the book, but I would like to hear what you say. Do you think that's still important in Ireland? Is this the bucolic old Catholic Ireland still around?
In some ways, but increasingly, and this is part of the liberalization of Ireland, church attendance is down. The reputation of the church has been in fairly steep decline. One of the few things that has kind of helped prop up Ireland, or the church in Ireland, ironically, is our immigrants. First in the 90s and 2000s, many of them coming from Poland during the Celtic Tiger. But recent scandals with the Catholic Church, the global one regarding predatory behavior by priests, but also very specific to Ireland, are the Magdalene laundries of the role of the church in controlling women who are pregnant, who become pregnant, and so on and so forth. That's a whole other topic. But I think the twin things there of those two things in Ireland has reduced, I think, the presence of the church. I mean, Ireland is still very very Catholic nation, of course, but we're starting to see Ireland catch up to, I think, other parts of Europe in terms of people turning away from the established church.
That's interesting. And how about the idea of Ireland as a nation of farmers?
Oh, that's there. that's I think will always be there. That that it's the biggest part of their economy, the production of grains and other things that are being exported. It's an agricultural nation. Speaking of Wisconsin, the shortcut is to compare Ireland in many ways to Wisconsin, that you do have aspects of industry, as you know, Milwaukee and Madison. But it's still primarily agriculture. It's the identity. It's the logo. It's the past, right? It's that primordial connection to the land. And so that will be there, and I'm sure will always be there because of that.
Yeah, it's interesting the way the European countries that are so industrialized love to hold on to that idea that they're actually a nation of farmers, you know, like, and mm-hmm. There's some kind of like sacred nature to the land. It's kind of charming. Mm-hmm. It's kind of silly as well, but... Who am I to judge? All right. I love the arc of this book. I love that it's well contained. I love that you make such a clear argument and then go and just relentlessly prove it. It's really well done. Excellent work. And so congratulations on that.
Thank you.
And it's great to be done with a book. Yes. It's between covers. It is. Yeah.
It is. Absolutely. And this book covered, a period of my life, and it comes out at a particularly good point, and it's very exciting, and it's nice to finally have it out, as you know.
Yeah, no, yeah, and there's a pathology about one's dissertation that like you just it's such an important part of your life, and it kind of sticks with you, and. You know, it's yeah, so well done. But there's also then this weird feeling that goes along with not having to write a book. You know, like, you know, because every time anyone asks you what you're doing this weekend, you're like, well, I got to work on my book. And you've been saying that for, you know, a decade. And so what, and then there's this weird feeling you're going to work on, oh, no, I'm not. What? What will I do? I mean, so yeah. So what are you working on now? What's next?
I have two projects.
Yeah.
one is one I'm really excited about, and I'm really excited to get working on it again. Is what I call the Shadow Metropole project, and this actually came out of a side project on the dissertation in which I wrote a paper for a class, and my professor said, you know, you need to globalize this. You know, he said that what I read De Valera doing sounds like what people. Because he's a Middle East North Africanist, that, you know, it's similar to what I see with the Wafd party in Egypt and other places. And he said, start looking out. And so I did, and I found Kwame Nkrumah of Ghana came to Ireland. And not only did he come to Ireland, he met with De Valera, and he said, I want to meet Emin De Valera. And he made a speech in which he says that both De Valera and himself were prison graduates, meaning that that they learned to be nationalists through prison. And so he's drawing comparisons between what he's doing and what De Valera is doing. And he goes further to say that what he was doing in Ghana replicates what De Valera was doing in Ireland in this time period that my book is about. And so I was like, wow, that's great. And so I explored that. And then once I got the opportunity, I started to explore further and found that there's something like four dozen, if not more, nationalist leaders from outside of Europe. So Africa, Asia, the Americas even, are coming to Ireland and they want to meet De Valera. They're coming there and they're saying, This is somebody that we've read about, U Thant, the of the UN, but also a Burmese nationalist, said the one thing that got him interested in national politics was that he read a biography of De Valera in Burma, that there was a Burmese national party that basically called themselves the Sinn Féin of Burma. There's the Sinn Féin of India, and so they're highlighting this. And there's a lot of work now on global connections of the Irish Revolution of the 19 teens and 20s, but there's nothing other than this project that I'm working on showing the connections between global nationalists and Ireland of the 20s and 30s. And so I'm finding more and more, especially within the British Empire, that you have these parties that are coming to Ireland, using Ireland as a guide, right? I mentioned Burma. Burma sent a delegation to Ireland to study their constitution. And the Burmese constitution that was in existence for a short time is based on the Irish constitution of 1937. You have leaders from Africa, Jomo Kenyatta. Oh, and back to Nkrumah. I haven't confirmed this, but I was told by an African historian that Nkrumah had a son named Eamon de Valera Nkrumah, which if I find okay. that, then argument done.
Done. But, we'll do a little dance in the archives.
Yes. But you even had leaders of the non-aligned movement coming. So you have leaders from Algeria, Egypt, and whatnot coming to Ireland saying, we want you to lead this. We want you to be a part of it because of your global reputation as being a nation that can push back against empire. And so the book is about that. My favorite anecdote of it is a Korean composer by the name of Ik Tae-on, who was exiled from Korea under in the 1930s, did a world tour in which he performed, or he had orchestras perform his work, and he conducted them. But he waited until the tour got to Dublin after being in Berlin, Paris, London, Philadelphia, New York, and whatnot. He waited until he was in Dublin to debut a new piece called the Aigeucha, which means patriotic song. And he said, I waited till Dublin because nobody but the Irish audience would understand this notion of what it means to be oppressed. And so the song he debuted is now the national anthem of South Korea. And so it was debuted in Dublin in the 1930s.
Wow.
So there's this sense that there's this connection with empire. And so that's something that I'm really excited about. And I have tons of material on it. And that's what the book I'll be working on next. But I also have another project. This is something that has emerged out of the rock and roll book. Is in that book, Dan, the co-author, and I included a chapter on post-punk. And that's a whole other episode. But in it, I was thinking, you know, is there an Irish post-punk? And so I started to investigate it because there are bands, U2, of course, The Virgin Prunes, My Bloody Valentine, and others. And I did some research into that and found that there's a distinct moment in which Irish post-punk is there. And so I started to, you know, talk about the music and everything. But then I started to make connections between Irish post-punk and the liberalization of Ireland. As I mentioned before, Ireland's increasingly liberalized. It's the first nation in the world to allow same-sex marriage through public plebiscite. You know, the Taoiseach up until last year, the prime minister, is an openly gay, biracial man. And that wasn't even a thing. People,
yeah,
they don't like his politics, but they don't care about his sexuality.
Yeah, amazing.
Legalization of abortion, amongst other things. Ireland's becoming incredibly liberalized. And so I connected the dots and said, okay, could post-punk in Ireland, this youthful movement, be a moment that signposts toward this liberalization mm-hmm. in the late 70s and 80s? And so those are the two things that I'm working on Ooh. Now. As if I'm I don't interested have anything there. Else to do.
Yeah, yeah, sure. Well, what? And what are you going to do? Be department chair?
Sure.
Oh, yeah, you are. Yeah, I'm interested in that dialectic of like post-punk and liberalism. I want to see how that goes. That's exciting. Yeah, God, that's cool. Your work is very cool. I've been racking my brain for a long time now to figure out what we can do together, but I don't know. There's just the, you know, the 500 years and all of Europe between our research areas. So
yeah, small problem. We'll just make something up.
Totally.
Centers of rock and roll, maybe?
Yeah, like centers of rock and roll. Center of all rock and roll. We can find that place. All right. Thank you. Thanks so much for joining me. My old friend, in fairness, mm-hmm. Ken and I have known each other for a while now. Yeah?
Yeah.
15 years?
At least, yeah.
A little bit longer than that, yeah.
I even mentioned your name in the book, so.
I saw. That was sweet. All right, so thanks so much for taking time to talk to me, as opposed to a real Irish historian about your book. But I'm really chuffed you wanted to talk to me about it.
Thank you.
And we'll be back. You know, we'll talk. We'll do this again in just in a few more years when you finish the next one.
Yeah, hopefully. Fingers crossed.
Fingers crossed. All right. Take care.
Thank you so much.